This is number 0093, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is once again another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0093. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet once again world-renowned science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. He's been on the program before. His new book is the third part of a trilogy. It's called World Wide Web Wonder. And Robert's science fiction always has a lot of hope in it.
Yeah, I'm an optimist, I'm a pacifist. I think there's far too much science fiction that is about nothing but fancy, super-powered weapons blowing things up indiscriminately. And I did want to have an optimistic view of the future. And that's my natural personality, so naturally it comes out in the books that I write.
Chelsea Cross is the author of 19, A Reflection of My Teenage Experience. She's also a philanthropist, and she has traveled to the poverty-ravaged Africa.
What I saw in the Kabir slums was poverty, disease, distress. I had to walk over dead bodies. I had to walk around people who were so high off of huffing glue that they couldn't even walk straight. But you know what else I saw? And this is what stays with me more than all of the poverty that I saw? Huge smiles on every little kid's face. That my dad was wearing polarized sunglasses and bent down to hug some of the children, and they were all fighting to look in his glasses because they had never seen their reflection before.
Sam Bobrick is a legendary television comedy writer, and he's also a playwright. Now, some television shows were easier to write for than others.
I wrote for Andy Griffith, one of my first half-hour shows, and with Don Knotts. And the two guys, you know, they were so wonderful together, it was so easy to write for them. They did have their characters already established. Then I remember doing some Bewitched shows, which, you know, was a hit, and that was very difficult because of the premise, you know, a woman who could do anything, you know, change anything she wanted.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0093, is Maureen Gibbons. She's a lifelong friend of mine. We actually met working together when we were 14 years old. We worked in movie theaters. She was a candy girl, I was an usher, and we had great times back then and remained friends all these years. And I thank you very much, Maureen, for doing the opening slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, in New Kensington, Pennsylvania, 22-year-old Stevie Hickey was arrested and will now stand trial on charges that she fed marijuana-laced margarine, yes, margarine, to a 12-year-old girl that she was babysitting, as well as two other children in her home. The 12-year-old's mother called police after discovering the drugs in a tub of, ironically, I can't believe it's not butter, in Ms. Hickey's freezer. The woman told police Hickey spread the substance on two pieces of toast and then gave it to her daughter. Hickey told the girl that it was parsley butter, but later admitted to police that it was marijuana. Marijuana in an I can't believe it's not butter tub. Wow. I can't believe she'll get another babysitting job. What about you? Meanwhile, moving right along, if you're still somehow under the impression that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is not completely crazy, this should put the final nail in that coffin. At the inauguration of a dam in Iran, Ahmadinejad made the startling claim that European countries are somehow stealing Iran's rain clouds, thus causing the drought that the Middle East country has been facing for years. Ahmadinejad said, "According to reports on climate, whose accuracy has been verified, European countries are using special equipment to force clouds to dump their water on their continent. By doing so, they prevent rain clouds from reaching regional countries, including Iran." Wow. Iranian leaders claim on a daily basis that Western countries, led by their arch foe, that devilish United States, devise plots to undermine the Islamic Republic and to impede its economic and scientific development. They also accuse world powers of colluding against Iran's national unity, independence, political establishment, culture, as well as international relations. Okay, the only thing standing between Iran and international relations is this wingnut. If Ahmadinejad is the best and brightest of his country's political leaders, just imagine the loons waiting in the wings for their chance to rule. Time to check his medication. Wow. And by the way, since Ahmadinejad is a Holocaust denier, it's only fitting that we follow up that story with one about the greatest batch of dangerous wingnuts the planet has ever seen. Looks like the infamous Nazis of the Second World War were even crazier than we thought. Now, according to new research by Dr. Jan Bondesen of Cardiff University, the Nazis actually tried to train dogs to talk, read, and spell. Their hope was to build a fearsome army of speaking dogs, and the brain trust behind the idea was Adolf Hitler himself. Hitler hoped dogs would learn to communicate with their SS masters and even had a special dog school set up to teach them to talk. Yes, a master race of dogs, go figure. Nazi officials are said to have recruited so-called educated dogs from all over Germany and trained them to speak and tap out signals using their paws. One mutt was even claimed to have uttered the words Mein Führer when asked who Adolf Hitler was. The bizarre experiment came to light after years of painstaking research by Dr. Bondesen, who visited Berlin to scour obscure periodicals for the material for his new book, which is entitled Amazing Dogs, A Cabinet of Canine Curiosities. He says it is absolutely extraordinary stuff. In the 1920s, Germany had numerous new animal psychologists who believed dogs were nearly as intelligent as humans and capable of abstract thinking and communication. Seriously, do I need to add a comment to that? No. Let's just move on. In Gastonia, North Carolina, 32-year-old Jason Douglas Gross lived up to his last name. After going through a Bojangles fried chicken restaurant drive-thru and ordering chicken legs, Jacqueline Green, who was working the window, explained that they had run out of chicken legs and offered to substitute something else. But rather than accept a substitute, Gross went berserk. He asked her twice, "You don't have any bleeping legs?" When Jacqueline replied, "No," Gross allegedly said, "Here's a bleeping leg for you," and proceeded to slowly pull down his jeans and boxer shorts, fully exposing his private parts. Miss Green later told police, "He did it gradually. It's going to be forever ingrained in my head." Green called a manager to the window and they got the license plate of Gross's minivan. Mr. Gross was later arrested and taken to a place where many will probably be delighted at the sight of his chicken leg and even happier to introduce him to theirs. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? You know, the Stuff File program is fast approaching the 100th show. This is show number 93. It's heard around the world by about 250,000 people, both online, on the air, in the air on China Airlines, and as a download. But back when I started this program 2 years ago, it had an audience that wasn't even measurable. Yet one of the people who graciously agreed to be a guest on the show way back when is world-renowned science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. Back then, we were talking to him about his book Flash Forward, which was being turned into a television series for ABC. Well, he's back with us now to talk about his latest book, the third of a trilogy called World Wide Web Wonder. Robert joins us on the line now. He's in Winnipeg. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And you're such a busy guy, such a prolific writer. You do so many things. So first of all, I'm glad you took the time to be on the show. I want to go back a little bit and talk about the experience you had dealing with ABC and doing Flash Forward. I just want to know, as a writer and as such a prolific writer, how did the experience of doing that change you or change fan response?
it was a wonderful experience. As you know, ABC did a whole season, 2009-2010, based on my novel, Flash Forward. The series starred Joseph Fiennes, and it was wonderful experience all around for me. They treated me well, with respect. I was involved in as a consultant on every single episode, including the pilot. I wrote one of the episodes, the 19th one, called Course Correction. I made friends amongst the cast, the crew, the staff writers. I learned an enormous amount about how that aspect of the business works. And really, it was one of the peak experiences of my life. My only regret is that we got canceled after a single season. And these things happen. Our ratings had slipped. That's the name of the game. I understand that in television. I've got a number of irons in the fire for other projects where I will have an even higher level of involvement with the television adaptations, and that is because of the experience that I gained on Flash Forward. So absolutely a terrific experience. The show is now out on DVD, and I commend it to people's attention. Still well worth watching, even though we're no longer on the air.
Absolutely. I'm just curious, did the show help the sales of the book?
Well, yes, of course it helped the sales of the novel Flash Forward, which is good. But what we were hoping for and what we did indeed, in fact, get is an uptick, a bump through the whole Robert J. Sawyer line. I have 20 novels in print. All of them went up in that 2009-2010 period over the same period the year before. Every book that I'd written got a bump from the TV series, and that was terrific.
I have to tell you from personal experience, when the television show came on, and I watched every episode, I loved it when it was on ABC, but there was a long hiatus period in the middle.
3.5 months. Oh, my goodness.
And it was during that hiatus that I said, you know, I've got to go out and buy this book and read it, just for comparison.
Oh,
so I read your book in the middle of the hiatus, and it really, and people always say, yes, books and television or movies are different, and there were great things about the book, great things about the show, and those things were were different. But it was really interesting, I thought, reading the book in between. It was almost like a flash forward sandwich.
Indeed. You know, it was a liberal adaptation, and I did not mind that. Before the series was made, before the pilot was even written, I sat down with David Goyer, who's known for Batman Begins, and Brandon Braga, known for his work on Star Trek The Next Generation and subsequent shows, to discuss what they wanted to do. They wrote the pilot script. And I signed off on all of the major changes they had in mind. And it was polite and gentlemanly of them to ask me in advance. It was not the usual Hollywood bait and switch. Oh, we love your stuff. Won't you sign it over to us, and then you never hear from them again? It was the exact opposite. We love it, but this is what we think has to be done to make it viable for American network television. Are you comfortable with that? If so, let's go ahead. If not, we shake hands, we've had a fine lunch, and we go our separate ways. So I was very pleased with the respect with which they approached the material. And Peter, I'm a huge fan of the original Planet of the Apes and its sequels. They're based on a novel by a French novelist, Pierre Boulez, who wrote also Ridge on the River Kwai. Very liberal adaptation of Boulez's novel is the original movie Planet of the Apes. So I went into this knowing that you can have night and day between what's in a book and what's on the screen, both equally, you know, good and exciting and equally appropriate for the given medium. So I had no problem about this at all, and I was thrilled with the way the series turned out.
Has the experience of being of doing that show, has it affected or changed the way you write today?
You know, absolutely. The book I'm just finishing as we talk, hopefully today, if not today, tomorrow, my 21st novel, is a thriller that's really kind of in the mold of the kind of writing that I did and all the other writers did on the Flash Forward TV series. A whole bunch of intertwined plot lines with a ticking clock in the background, conspiracy theories swirling underneath it all, and a neat science fictional trick. I liked that kind of really fast pacing that we did on Flash Forward, and maybe a higher level of explosions and people pulling guns than normally occurred in a Robert J. Sawyer novel. And so I'm trying my hand at writing a novel that more closely hews to that particular brand of storytelling.
Now let's flash forward to the current book, which is out there right now, and that's World Wide Web Wonder. It's part of a trilogy, the last book of a trilogy. There was Wake, Watch, and now Wonder. Tell us about it.
Right. Wonder is indeed the third volume. The first volume, the World Wide Web gains consciousness, wakes up and basically says hello to a blind teenage Girl from Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And the second book, The World Wide Web Consciousness Has Grown More Sophisticated and has now come out and announced itself to the world at large. In the third book, Wonder, the United States government and others try to bring it down, fearing that this is the end of the human era, that once a super intelligent machine comes fully into engagement with the whole wide world, we will be any of those things you've seen in other science fiction properties, subjugated like in The Matrix, eliminated like in The Terminator, or absorbed like in The Borg from Star Trek, but that there would be no place for us. And this final book is that final issue about whether or not we can find a way that's a win-win scenario for us and for this super intelligence that spontaneously emerged out of the complexity of the Internet.
The thing that I find interesting in the concept is there is a similarity with Flash Forward in that with your books, there is hope. It's not always it's us and them and one has to win.
Yes. In fact, when I went out to write Wake, Watch, and Wonder, I tried to contrive a series that had no antagonist in it, no bad guy in it. There's no Darth Vader. They're all Luke Skywalkers. They have different points of view, but they all are trying to do what they honestly think is best for humanity and for this this new world order that's emerging. And I really do think, absolutely, I'm an optimist, I'm a pacifist. I think there's far too much science fiction that is about nothing but fancy, super-powered weapons blowing things up indiscriminately. And I did want to have an optimistic view of the future. And that's my natural personality, so naturally it comes out in the books that I write.
Again, using the flash-forward TV experience, when you write something like this now, in your mind's eye, do you envision it as either something theatrical or for television?
You know, I don't. I do. The scenes are very visual to me, but a lot of authors can even tell you, you know, who would be the ideal person to cast in a given part. And I get asked that frequently. I have no idea. I don't think of the characters in my novel as things that actors will someday be auditioning for. So, yes, I like to think that the scenes are visual and that you can picture them as a reader very vividly in your mind. But no, I'm not really thinking that far ahead. I'm trying to do the best job of creating a novel that I can. And then when afterwards people come and start expressing interest in adapting them, well, so much the better. Gravy.
Where do you find the time? You say you're just finishing your 21st novel.
Right.
You're also the editor of Robert J. Sawyer Books. You're a teacher. And I have to admit, you're one of the best when it comes to promoting your work, which for some people, that's a job in itself.
It is. And there are all those elements to it. And the bottom line is, there's nothing I would rather be doing than writing science fiction. All of the other stuff, and when you say teacher, you mean that I teach science fiction writing from time to time.
Yes.
All of that other stuff is necessary. The promotion, I have been on the road now for 2 months, and right around the world, I went through all 24 time zones in the last 2 months, promoting Wonder and other works of mine. I'm in Winnipeg today, and I'm off tomorrow to Phoenix for a huge 20,000-person Phoenix Comic Con convention down there that I'm one of the guests at. Immediately after that, with only an 18-hour turnaround in Toronto, where I live, I head off to 2 weeks in Italy because I'm guest of honor at the Italian National Science Fiction Convention this year. The answer is I write in airport lounges. I write sitting in planes. I write sitting in hotel rooms. I often will be driven somewhere in a car, and I'm sitting in the passenger seat writing on my laptop. I write whenever and wherever I can, and try to never let a moment go to waste during the day.
That shows some amazing focus.
You got to get it done. Everything else falls apart if I stop producing the books. I do a book a year, and all the other good things in my life spin from that. The TV series Flash Forward, getting to go, as I say, to Phoenix tomorrow and Italy next week. All of that would dry up, Peter, if I did it actually on a routine basis, produce a new book and keep it in the pipeline. So I've got to, you know, I'm dancing as fast as I can. And of course, try and take a moment now and again to stop and enjoy things. I've got, you know, some days set aside in Italy for sightseeing, for instance.
Well, you certainly do a great job at it. And we love the work that comes out of as prolific as you are. And I thank you very, very much, Robert, for taking the time to be on the program with us once again. It's both for the listener's point of view and personally for taking a stab at being on a show way back when that not very many people heard, but now is a lot bigger than it was then.
Well, Peter, it's my pleasure, and congratulations on just the phenomenal growth of this show. I'm delighted to have been there at the beginning and here now, and want to be with you for a long time to come.
Robert J. Sawyer, author of World Wide Web, Wonder. It's the third book in his trilogy, the first two being World Wide Web, Wake, and World Wide Web, Watch. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0093, and you can find links to Robert's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly for the Kindle.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, you'll meet Chelsea Cross, who is the author of 19, A Reflection of My Teenage Experience, plus Sam Bobrick, who is a former television comedy writer and a current award-winning playwright. He's on to talk about his career and some of the stuff he's done. That's all coming your way. Of course, there's also an Idiot of the Day and more Stuff File news, including right here, right now. In Plainsville, Ohio, 20-year-old Grace Nash and 22-year-old Bruce Crawford made the bad decision of rafting down the flood-swollen Grand River without life preservers. After being spotted by witnesses who called emergency rescue services, searchers spent hours looking for the couple last month, certain they were in danger. The couple had made it safely to land, but later lied to an official about even being on the water. So the judge in the case gave them the option of 60 days in jail or a most creative sentence of community service. They opted for community service, and so both of them had to stand in one of those tiny kid swimming pools, you know, those wading pools, while wearing life jackets and handing out water safety brochures all day Saturday at a festival in Plainsville. Ms. Nash later told reporters that they had learned their lessons. Oh, how I love creative sentencing. Kudos to that judge. Okay. Moving to the great state of Texas. Oh, sure, Texas is still facing a multi-billion-dollar state budget deficit and more major funding cuts for public schools, but there is a silver lining in this cloud. The Texas legislature has moved to make the Lone Star State safe for noodling. Yes, noodling, the time-honored southern practice of catching catfish by hand. Now, up until now, noodling had been illegal in Texas, and noodlers were subject to a fine of up to $500. But lawmakers approved legislation to make what some called hillbilly hand fishing legal at last. State Senator Bob Duell said, "I personally don't noodle, but I would defend to the death your right to do so." And Marty Jenkins, who runs the website catfishgrabbers.com, yes, there is a website, catfishgrabbers.com, and I've put a link into it from my website if you want to check it out for yourself. Anyway, he says noodling is an age-old southern tradition and added, "It can be a family sport. We get out there and laugh at each other, see who can get the fish out of the water, see who can get the fish without losing it." Most states ban the practice because they think it's cruel, but Jenkins contends it's no more cruel than catching a fish with a fish hook. The bill now goes to Governor Rick Perry for his consideration. By the way, it is currently not known what his position on noodling is. That's still a big secret. Anyway, it's good to hear that there are no other pressing issues in the state of Texas that they can spend time on noodling. Good to hear. Okay, while the whole world was hearing Harold Camping bellowing about the fact that the world was ending, you know, the end of the world thing, well, it's getting kind of tired, that whole story. Now, here's the latest from the nut job who is the head of the Family Radio International. Camping explains the reason we're all still here by saying that he was off by 5 months and that the Earth actually will be obliterated on October 21st. Camping apologized for not having the dates worked out as accurately as I could have, so mark your calendar for more amusing Camping comments coming your way on October 22nd. And for those of you crazy enough to believe this guy, please don't dump any more of your money or life savings. God knows Camping didn't do the same. He's still sitting on $70 million or so. My prediction? You'll soon start seeing lawsuits from those duped by this idiot and who threw away their life savings and jobs. They probably won't win, but they'll try to sue anyway. Just you watch. It'll be good times. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, it could have been the scam of the century. A Los Angeles woman had set up a meeting to sell a rare piece of moon rock to an interested buyer for $1.7 million. Only two things wrong with this plan. First, it's illegal to sell moon rock, and it's doubtful that you even have one. Second, the buyer was an undercover NASA agent who quickly confiscated the alleged moon rock. The gray rocks, which are considered national treasures, were given to each U.S. state and 136 countries by then-President Richard Nixon after U.S. moon missions. They indeed can sell for millions on the black market. At this point, NASA plans to conduct tests to determine whether the rock the suspect was selling actually came from the moon, as the woman claimed. The woman has not been arrested or charged, and it's not known how she obtained the rock or came to the attention of NASA. If the rock is genuine, the suspect could face theft charges, and if it's fake, fraud charges. Most purported moon rocks offered for sale on the internet are bogus, though authentic moon rocks can be purchased if they came to Earth in the form of a meteorite. A rock presented to Honduras was recovered in 1998 by NASA in a sting operation after a Miami collector offered $5 million for it. Wow. So this woman can go to jail for either theft charges or fraud charges. Wow. Door number one or door number two. Enjoy your choices. Okay, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Chelsea Cross is the author of the recently released book, 19, A Reflection of My Teenage Experience, and is the host of her own radio talk show, Teen Talk Live. She's also a millennial spokesperson, TV journalist, writer, motivational speaker, and teen philanthropist. Not busy at all. She joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on with us. You're very, very busy for already a very short life. would you say you're more of an outgoing go-getter than your peers?
Well, I would definitely say that outgoing is something that you could use to describe me. My mom said that I was born with the gift of gab. I love to talk. I love to talk to people. I love talking about what's going on in the world, what's going on in my life, and relating it to anybody else's problems or triumphs or hurdles out there. I'm a people person, and I don't know how to really not be productive. And, you know, I'm really busy, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
So, as you say, having the gift of gab from infancy, basically, was this something, the things that you do, your philanthropy, all of your work, was this something that was encouraged in you in childhood by your parents?
Well, I would say that my parents I praise my parents like every single day. My mom is my best friend. She's also my manager. And my dad is my rock and my mentor. And I admire him so much. And my parents brought both my brother and I, the younger brother, up to always be verbal, to always be open and honest. And if we ever had a question, it was never a dumb question. So right as soon as I learned how to talk, I wasn't scared to talk because I knew my parents would talk back to me. And I think that's something that's so important, that sometimes parents and children don't have that relationship today because there's so much out there that, ooh, they want to guard their children from hearing. So it was something that was definitely it was definitely comfortable in my household, but it was something that I was naturally born with. I always felt that communicating came very easy to me. I feel like I have a very big chameleon effect, that doesn't matter where I am or who I'm talking to, I can somehow adapt to the environment or the person and find something in common.
At what point did you decide to write the book, 19?
When I was a freshman in high school, I enrolled in television production, and little did I know that taking that class was really going to start my career and blossom me into this broadcaster that I have become. And when I was in my freshman year of college, so then 4 years later, I said, you know what? I have met so many extraordinary people through my radio talk show and have experienced so many life-changing experiences through my missionary trips to Africa and Peru, and just, you know, being so productive within charity. I want to have an open memoir for myself, because I wanted to remember every nitty-gritty detail, and also to share to other girls out there, because other girls would come to me and they would be like, Chelsea, you went through some hardships in your life, but you overcame them so much stronger than, you know, I could ever imagine for myself. So that's when I was like, you know what, I'm going to just start jotting down some thoughts. And then that turned into pages and pages and pages. And then it morphed into this beautiful book that I'm so proud of.
Now, I want to talk about that last title that I mentioned in the introduction, and that's Teen Philanthropist. You also touched on that just a few moments ago. You've been to missionary trips to both Africa and Peru. How did that come about, and what did you experience there?
When I was a junior in high school, so 16 at the time, I was doing my radio talk show and always incorporating charities, always, 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 from as little as I can remember. I was going to every Hanukkah and Christmas, you know, I would go through my closet and see the toys that I didn't play with as much anymore and give them back. So all I knew growing up was giving as much as receiving. And when I was 16 in high school, I had the first ever Rwandan refugee, Christine Uwazu, from Rwanda to Boca Raton, Delray Beach, Florida, on my show live with me, telling her heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching story. And as soon as her and I met, I'm not kidding, she was a soul sister of mine. When I think about her, it's hard for me not to tear up, because I just love her so much. And her drive and passion for life is something that's just rubbed off on me, and I hope everybody else who listens to the show. And I looked at my mom after the show and I said, Mom, this is it. Like, we're going to Africa, and this is our first missionary trip, because I was itching to go out of the country and help any way possible. And literally, we did it. We started fundraising and charity functions, and within the next 6 months, we planned our missionary trip to Africa, and we got off the plane in Africa, and within the hour, we were in our first slum, the Kibera slums. And what I saw in the Kibera slums was poverty, disease, distress. I had to walk over dead bodies. I had to walk around people who were so high off of huff and glue that they couldn't even walk straight. But you know what else I saw? And this is what stays with me more than all of the poverty that I saw. Huge smiles on every little kid's face. That my dad was wearing polarized sunglasses and bent down to hug some of the children. And they were all fighting to look in his glasses because they had never seen their reflection before. So these little nitty-gritty details are the things that I don't take for granted anymore, of looking in a mirror and having a bed to sleep in and not having to walk over my own sewage. And instead of going there and being so depressed when I got back, I came back so more uplifted and ready to embark on my journey of life. And that just propelled me to take on anything and go with it. So no holds barred. There's nothing I can't do, I feel. And doing missionary work and charity work is something that every person should do. And they won't understand the feeling until they get involved. But I call charity my choice of drug, because it's addicting. Once you help one person and you see that reaction, you just want more.
What was it like, though, going to this first African trip of yours? What was it like the second you came back home and stepped back on American soil? into your own neighborhood. What went through your mind?
And I have to say that I grew up in an extremely beautiful and extremely wealthy community. So I got off the plane from the slums where I didn't wear makeup for 17 days and I didn't care about what I wore for 17 days. And honestly, being clean sometimes was hard. And I walked back into this lush land of green and riches and designer labels and materialistic objects. And fancy cars and big houses and gated communities. And I cried getting on the plane because I knew that's where I was going back to, but my heart was still in Africa because I felt more at peace in Africa, even amongst all the distress. And I said, you know what, this is like raw, nothing is sugar-coated here, and there is so much happiness even with so little. So what I did instead after, you know, sobbing on the plane, I said, you know what, I'm not going to go back and resent where I grew up and resent who I know. I'm going to bring with me a piece of Africa back to the States and try to share the message of you too can get involved in the organizations and charities that I was involved with and feel this piece of happiness within Africa. So it definitely was a huge paradigm shift going from the slums in Africa to, you know, the suburbs of Delray Beach. It was an adjustment. And when I think about Africa, I get the biggest smile on my face, and I encourage every single person to take advantage of any opportunity they have to go out there.
Your show, Teen Talk Live, I understand you were surprised not just by the fact that you have a large audience, but it's not just teens.
No, it's not. And that was actually extremely surprising to me when I started the radio show. I started my first live radio premiere was at 16 years old. And my biggest demographic within the first week was actually the parents and grandparents. And the parents and grandparents, I later found out that they wanted to get in tune and in touch with not only their grandchildren and children, but into the mindset of my generation. Because we are so different than the generation before us. We're growing up with technology. We're growing up, you know, using cyber communication just as much as in-face communication. We're so different. We're kind of like programmed differently because we grow up learning these intense programs with technology. It's crazy. It's really crazy when you think about it, how different not necessarily my childhood, but a little bit younger than me, that all they know is technology today. So parents and grandparents were so enthralled to hear not only myself, but other teenagers like me talking amongst each other and talking about really important topics like body image and bullying and mean girls and plastic surgery and fashion and anything under the sun, really, I've talked about on the show. So it's kind of bridged each generation gap. Younger than myself, a little bit older than myself, my parents' age and my grandparents' age. Everyone can come together and listen to my show and relate to one another in some way, shape, or form. And that's been beautiful.
People can find out more information by going to your website, which is www.chelseacross.com. That's KROST.com, correct?
Absolutely. And my website is going through complete transformation right now. I'm so excited. It's going to be way more user-friendly. And my site right now is still the same from when I was 16. And it's amazing, you know, how technology just blossoms every year. You need to keep updated. So it's going through a big transition right now.
Chelsea, I thank you for being on the program with us, and I'm very impressed at all the things you've managed to do. I can't wait to see what you're going to do next.
Thank you so much.
Chelsea Cross, author of 19, A Reflection of My Teenage Experience. She's also the host of Teen Talk Live. Now, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0093, where you'll find links to Chelsea's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order her book directly for the Kindle. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Remember the story of the boy who cried wolf? It's about sounding a false alarm so often that people stop listening even when there's real danger. A gentleman who heard a report about our wacky warning label contest sent us a note with a modern-day twist on that story. He's a hunter and owns many types of guns. All of them came with a warning to wear ear protection, even the guns that aren't loud. Over the years, he started ignoring the warnings because the guns were so quiet. Then, one day, a new gun with the same warning fired a shot so loud that it still causes ringing in his ears today. Let's be fair. A warning to use ear protection when firing a loud gun is certainly not wacky. However, this man's experience provides a lesson. The fear of lawsuits that has led to warnings on virtually everything has made many of us deaf to the warnings that are really needed. It's one more example of how lawsuit abuse is jeopardizing public safety. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're in the home stretch here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have time for just one more Stuff File news story. So you know what that would be? That would be the idiot of the day, and that's coming up in just a matter of moments here on the Stuff File program. As a matter of fact, we're going to get to our next guest right now. Sam Bobrick is a legendary television writer. His career goes from Captain Kangaroo to The Andy Griffith Show to Get Smart, The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, Saved by the Bell, and more. He's also written many plays, including Norman, Is That You? A stage reading of his current play, The Psychic, will be performed on July 26th at the Writers Guild in Los Angeles as a special presentation of their Seasoned Readings program in honor of Sam winning this year's Edgar Award for Best Mystery Play from the Mystery Writers of America. So he's not exactly slacking off here, but he joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. As I said, you're not slacking off. You are definitely keeping busy, and you've written in, even though primarily you're known for comedy, you've written in various genres.
Yeah, I have. I have, and that's why I'm so tired.
What made you change from comedy, or what made you head toward mystery? Let me ask that question.
Well, I don't know. I've always liked mystery, and I like doing different things. You know, sometimes you keep writing the same things over and over. You run into yourself, you know, and you have to change around. I found I always had to change around. That's why writing for television, I always had a difficult time staying with the show too long, because it really got monotonous. And I once read little adage that kind of like really gave me a direction. It said, if you're not doing something different, you're not doing anything at all. And I said, you know, that's pretty good, because I sometimes, you know, you put, especially with the half-hour shows, it's like almost on automatic drive a lot of times, you know. A lot of them, you know, the shows used to be on 26 weeks a year, the same, you know, same series. And sometimes you just get kind of tired of it, you know. Some shows you don't get tired of it, but most shows, I would say, most half hours, I did get tired doing them, you know, and I wanted to switch around, write other characters, you know, do other things.
When people talk about writers, they talk about, or particularly screenwriters or playwrights, they talk about Broadway plays, off-Broadway plays. They talk about the great writers of some of those great comedies in the 30s and 40s of film.
Mozart and...
Exactly.
Those people, yeah.
But a lot of people, I wouldn't say a lot of people, but people seem to overlook the type of writing that folks like yourself did in the heyday of television. Writers didn't seem to get their due. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, the writer out here in California, for some reason, is not thought of very well. And now in New York, comedy writers, American comedy writers, are not doing very well. And I think it's just a mindset, you know. I came from television. That's where I learned, you know, I learned my craft. I did a lot of stuff. And a lot of times when we go to New York with a play, I have a partner who also is from Montreal. I wrote my first four plays with him, Ron Clark. And... they would just kill us in New York. You know, we were TV writers, they would call us. You know, we were sitcom writers, and that was kind of frowned upon in New York. And once I was in Kansas City doing a play, you know, and a critic was interviewing me, and I said, did you read the play? He said, yeah, I read it. I said, the play was called Remember Me. I said, what did you think of it? He says, well, it's kind of a situation comedy. I said, can you think of any comedy comedy that you've seen on Broadway that wasn't a situation comedy? And he kind of thought, and he said, well, you got me there, you know. Comedies are situations, you know, that's what happens, you know. And When I was in Paris, a lot of my plays do very, very well overseas, much better than they do here in the States. I mean, maybe I don't do well in English, I guess. I don't know. But somebody said to me, we had a play that ran 5 years. It was Norman Azadieu, as a matter of fact, ran 5 years in Paris. And somebody said, how does it feel to be famous? And I looked around to see who he was talking to. And he says, you know, and it was me. And I said, God, they think I'm famous. Well, in Europe, they have streets named after poets and writers and everything. And here, you know, this country, they don't look that well on, I guess, comedy writers. There's no street called Larry Gelbart or, you know, Doc Simon.
Hmm. Now, when looking at the various shows you've had the chance to work on, you've worked on shows that had some name stars on them. You've also worked on shows like Saved by the Bell, which no one really knew who those kids were before the show became a hit.
Right.
What's easier to do, writing a show for where the character is the most important thing, or trying to fit a particular star's personality by writing a character for him or her?
Well, you know what? It varies. You know, I wrote for Andy Griffith in one of my first half-hour shows when we came out. Do you remember that show?
Oh, absolutely.
Andy Griffith show?
Yeah.
And with Don Knotts. And the two guys, you know, they were so wonderful together. It was so easy to write for them, you know. They did have their characters already established. Then I remember doing some Bewitched shows, which, you know, was a hit. And that was very difficult because of the premise, you know, a woman who could do anything, you know, change anything she wanted. I don't know, you know, it varies, you know, every show is different, you know, so I can't be a judge. There really is no formula for success. You just, if you're lucky, you've got a successful show, and like Seinfeld, you know, nobody really knew who he was, and they developed into wonderful, wonderful characters, you know. And I'm sure at first it must have been tough writing for that show because you didn't know who these people were. But then as the show went on and you got to know their characters, it became easier. I never wrote a Seinfeld, but I just love that show.
Well, I was about to ask that question. What do you see today on contemporary television that makes you laugh or makes you think, gosh, if I had a shot at writing something like that?
Yeah. You know what? Believe it or not, I don't watch very many half hours anymore. I watch, you know, like the Bill Maher and Jon Stewart and Colbert. You know, those are the kind of shows I like. They're fun. And I always liked, believe it or not, I loved writing variety shows much better than the half-hour shows because they were more show business. I mean, it was instant, it was fast, it was music. You had to get it on now. And it was fun. I always found the variety shows much more fun, much more alive than the half-hours. So I still watch Seinfeld reruns. I love that show. And
Larry
Davis, I love his show, you know. But I don't watch that much anymore. And also, I think it's my attitude. I said, if they're not going to pay me, I'm not going to watch it.
Now, you mentioned you enjoyed doing variety shows. You, I alluded earlier to the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was fun, but it was also very political at that time being on the show. Did you feel at the time that show was on when you were working on it that you were doing something that was, in some circles, certainly with the CBS censors, somewhat taboo?
Yeah. Well, politically, we love making comments. You know, it was so good to have a place to make comments about, you know, what was happening in the world. But I never felt it. We never went as far as the shows go nowadays. And I think to be a writer to write sketches and things like Saturday Night Live nowadays, I would think would be so much fun because there's no censorship. Yeah, we were censored every now and then, but I don't know. I wasn't there the third year. My partner, Ron Clark, and I, we got a job in New York doing the Kraft Music Hall. And so we left the Smothers Brothers. It was the third year, and that's the year that they had all the trouble. So we somehow avoided that. But It was a fun show, and I liked doing it. And Tommy and Dickie were, you know, they were kind of rascals at the time, and it was fun. But looking back at it, if you would look at the shows now, they would seem so mild compared to what's going on now.
And on another end of the scale, you also worked for a brief period of time on the Flintstones.
Oh, well, that just, you know, the writer out here, what it used to be was you would get an assignment, write the show, usually write it at home and submit it, you know. Like, I was never on the set of the Andy Griffith Show, although I did get to know Don Knotts very well, and I knew Andy pretty well. But you just wrote them, you know, and submitted them, you know, and handed it in. So I don't remember how many scripts I did on the Flintstones, but maybe four or five. I don't remember, you know.
So what you're saying is you never met Fred and Barney, right?
Well, I've gone to dinner with them. No, it was, you know, Joe Barbera who was really in charge of the writing, was Hanna-Barbera, and Hanna did the artwork, and Joe did the scripts, you know. He was just a terrific guy, and it was a lot of fun to work with him, you know. So that was fun, but, you know, then I went on, did other things.
As I mentioned, you're still writing. You have the stage reading of your play, The Psychic, coming up.
I write plays because, you know, I don't do very much TV anymore. I really kind of stopped around 20 years ago, you know. That's I was approaching 60. I'm now 79. And so when we did the Kraft Music Hall in New York, my partner and I, it was a great show. We used to write, it was so easy. It was mostly singing, you know. I don't know if you remember that show.
Oh, absolutely.
But
yes.
We were signed to do the summer show. There was, I guess, 10 shows or 12 shows with Eddie Arnold. And we used to write two shows in a day, you know, and then we would have 2 weeks with nothing to do. So we were in New York. We said, let's write a play. And that's how we wrote our first play, Norman Is That You. We were, you know, once I got into the theater, you know, once I started doing, like, working for the stage, I was hooked. I loved it. Even though they kicked the hell out of us, you know, the critics. When Norman Is That You opened, we thought it was going to be the biggest hit ever, because the audience were roaring. We said, well, this is it. And then the critics came in and just killed it, you know. And I remember reading, I said, God, this is awful. Did I write this bad a play? And I remember, I think it was the New York Post. They had a story that day about a killer who killed some woman and pushed her down the elevator and, you know, stabbed her and beat her up and everything. And I said, oh, my God, they're nicer to this killer than they are to us. You know, the critics just killed us. But the play went on to just do well, and it still does well, and we still get productions of it. But I just loved writing for the theater. I loved writing for live audiences, and I guess that's why I like variety shows so much. Mm. And that's why I, when television kind of dried up for me, you know, and it does, you know, they just, television to me used to be a scholarship kind of a thing. As soon as I'd make enough money, I'd quit and write plays. And I've written a number of plays. I've had 21 published, and God knows I've written more than have in my trunk.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I didn't even get a chance to talk about a movie of yours that I really enjoyed, which is the last remake of Beau Geste.
Oh,
Marty,
did you like it?
With,
yeah,
Marty Feldman. I unfortunately haven't got time to talk about that. But
Call me anytime you want. I have nothing to do.
I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. And
Peter,
it's a pleasure talking to you.
For calling. I wish my children would call.
Okay, legendary television writer Sam Bobrick. You can visit his website at sambobrick.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program for this show, which is show number 0093, and you'll find links to Sam's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
look up the word idiot in the dictionary and you may soon see a picture of 36-year-old Terrence Dunn, an inmate at the Iowa Prison Classification Center in Coralville, Iowa. Dunn just managed to get 8 more years tacked onto his sentence after he sent the FBI a letter threatening the president and threatening to blow up a couple of federal buildings. In the letter, Dunn said he was part of an underground organization that was going to blow up 2 federal buildings and had a plan to go after the president. The letter read, "I have a master plan to have Barack Obama killed, and this plan is foolproof." Apparently it wasn't so foolproof because Dunn was dumb enough to put a return address on the envelope, which led authorities straight to him. He later admitted to writing the letter. I don't even have to rehash this moron's plan. I'll just simply say, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0093. Hope you enjoyed it. The Stuff File is found on the website at thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's number 0093. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.